The following live presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
This is a very interesting portion, partly because the topics seem to be so disparate. Okay, the two major themes that run through this week's portion, right, are the story of Nadav and Avihu. Nadav and Avihu were the two sons of Aaron, and literally at one of the highest points in Jewish history, when the Jewish people, after a year, and we've spoken about this before, some of us, when the Jewish people, after a year of almost being incommunicado with God, after the sin of the golden calf and all the mistakes that had been made, finally dedicated the Mishkan, the tabernacle, which at least according to Rashi, one of the super commentaries on the Bible, may well have been given as a mitzvah to build as a result, as a consequence, as a way to do a little fixing after the mistake of the golden calf. And on the eighth day of the dedication ceremonies, which was the day that the tabernacle was actually dedicated, the day that that the Jewish people first acquired a priesthood, a clan of priests, of Kohanim, the day in which Aaron was to become the high priest. On this day, Aaron's two older sons, who were clearly part of the major leadership in the Jewish people, were struck down by fire from heaven. Doesn't get any more direct than that. And joy, in an instant, turns into tragedy. Very, very difficult question. If you had to pick a place in the entire Torah that deals with the question of why the righteous suffer, and how we understand human suffering from a Jewish perspective, and where is God, and where was God when? Fill in the blank. Where was God when the Holocaust occurred? Where was God when the Spanish Inquisition occurred? Where was God when the Chmelnytsky massacres occurred? Where was God when a six-year-old boy was diagnosed with cancer? And on and on and on. Right? If you had to pick a place that deals with that challenging question, this would be it. This would be it. And we're not actually going to take the question on tonight, because we have discussed it before. And if, by the way, you're curious as to some thoughts on the topic, feel free to email me via Israelite's email, and I will be happy to send it to you. Nobody should misunderstand that as a suggestion that I have the answer, or that we have the answer to this question, but the struggle with the question and the response to the question, which is very different from answering the question, because I'm not so sure that these questions are meant to be answered. That's one of the topics. That's the introduction of this portion. The other major topic that carries through this theme, in addition, of course, to the dedication of the Mishkan, of the tabernacle, are the laws of kashrut, the laws of keeping kosher, the dietary laws. Right? This is the week, right in the middle of all this, right, where the Torah begins to describe what you can eat and what you don't eat. And the obvious question, right, this is in the 11th chapter, right, Vayedaber Hashem el Moshe ve'el Aaron le'mor, and Hashem speaks to Moses and Aaron speaking, right, in the middle of the portion of Shemini, right? Debul b'nei Yisrael le'mor, speak to the Jewish people, saying, Zot ha'chaya asher tochlu, this is what the animal that you can eat, right? These are the animals that are okay. Kol mafreset parsa, animals that chew their cud, shosat shesa, I'm sorry, animals with split hooves, animals that chew their cud, right? Malegera, right? An animal that regurgitates, that chews its cud. These are the animals that you can eat. So one wonders what the connection is. What are the laws of kashrut doing in the middle of the portion that deals with human tragedy? Now, the most obvious connection is that these are two topics which seem to be presented as the ostensibly incomprehensible. Those items that we're not necessarily meant to understand. Right? In fact, in Jewish tradition, there are three types of mitzvot, three types of commandments, what are called, and there are different names for them, but we'll call them Torot, Mishpatim, or Mitzvot, Mishpatim, and Chukim. Right? So, a Torah or a Mitzvah is a law which makes a lot of sense. Right? And there are different opinions as to which is which, so forget the terminology for the moment, right? But there's a type of mitzvah which makes a lot of sense, and probably you would have figured that out on his own. You don't need to be a genius to figure out that it makes sense not to murder. It makes sense practically, it makes sense ethically, it makes sense as a social contract, society would break down, right? And you probably would have figured that out. Most societies have some sort of code against murder, even without Torah and without God and without mitzvah. Even, by the way, Nazi Germany had code against murder. Right? It was illegal to murder in Nazi Germany. They just had a different definition of what murder was. But the idea that murder is prohibited, that makes a lot of sense. And you could have figured that out without the Torah. And then you have mitzvot, where you probably wouldn't have come to it on your own. But once you hear it, once the Torah commands us to do it, so then it makes a lot of sense. I don't know, Shabbat. I'm not sure that we would have come up with the idea, mystically, that every seventh day we take off. That 6 days a week you work, and on the seventh day you're meant to focus and to struggle with what all that work is about. That you need to take a day to develop your relationship with God, with yourself, with your family, whatever Shabbat is to you. But once you have the mitzvah, and once the Torah asks of us to do this, it makes a lot of sense. People that have a hard time with Shabbat, and this is just an opinion, you know, it's not about making assumptions, but people, I've always felt that people that have a hard time with Shabbat, they've just never experienced the Shabbat that I've experienced. Because if you experience the Shabbat the way I experience Shabbat, I can't imagine why you wouldn't want it in your life. You know, it's kind of like marriage. You know, when a person goes through a tough time and struggles, and eventually thinks that marriage is a terrible institution, they're probably right, because the marriage that they're in is a terrible institution. But if you would be in a marriage that was different, if you would be in my marriage, you would think marriage is wonderful. And of course, my wife may be listening, so I'm being careful. but then you have mitzvot, that even after the Torah asks of us to do it, it's still hard to make sense of it. And those mitzvot are called chok, chukim. In fact, the word chok, right, is very much related to the word chakuk, which means to be engraved. It's hammered, it's chiseled out of the stone. It's set. It's not something you get to play around with. It's not something you get to question and struggle with and focus and influence. This is what God wants you to do. And there are, by the way, chukei hateva. Right? If you jump out of a 100-story building, you will fall to the ground. That is a chok. That's a rule engraved in the laws of nature. Right? You may like it, you may not like it, you may think it makes sense, you may think it doesn't make sense, but that's what it is. I think personally it doesn't make a lot of sense that we have to sleep every day. Because if we didn't have to sleep every day, we would be able to accomplish so much more, right? If Mahatma Gandhi hadn't slept, if Mother Teresa hadn't slept, if the Lubavitcher Rebbe hadn't slept, how much more good would be in the world? Makes no sense. Doesn't matter. That's the law. That's the rule that God put into the world, that people are going to have to sleep, and that's just the way it is. And there are mitzvot that are called chukim, and those mitzvot, technically speaking, are mitzvot that are very difficult to comprehend. One of those mitzvot is kashrut, the laws of keeping kosher. The laws of keeping kosher, like for example the fact that that if you take the ashes of a red heifer and you burn, you know, you offer up that red heifer, that red cow, and you take that ashes and you mix it with a certain type of water, that somehow somebody who's impure will become pure. Very difficult to understand. The laws of the red heifer, the parah adumah, not really completely within the purview of our comprehension, right? And kashrut is an example. Makes no sense, right? I mean, you take a perfectly good kosher piece of meat, you mix it with a perfectly good piece of kosher cheese, and all of a sudden it's not kosher. It makes no sense, right? I mean, doesn't God know it all gets mixed up inside anyhow? Right? So there was something about kashrut that is not completely comprehensible. And on a certain level, that may be part of the connection. Because what is the ultimate chok? The ultimate law which we can never fully comprehend? The great divide, death. And especially death by tragedy. You know, I've mentioned a couple of times that I had a very, you know, cousin whose family I'm very close with, Benji, who was killed this last summer. He was a commander in Egos, one of the elite units, company commander. And his family decided this year that he has a younger brother, there are three of them, And his sister's married, but his younger brother, Shimon, just decided, like, he just couldn't handle being home for Seder. Like, for all of them to be home, and that missing chair, Nuch, they had gotten married 3 weeks before he was killed, so it was a missing couple, and this would have been their first married Pesach. So he asked his parents, said, we got to go away somewhere. So they decided with Judith's sister, you know, the two sisters, they're very close. They went away for Pesach. They went away to whatever hotel in Israel. And, you know, obviously they felt it was very smart, and I'm sure they were right. I'm happy to not have enough experience in the matter. And so they were away from home. So I spoke to one of them afterwards, you know, about the Seder and how it was, and the ups, the downs, the challenges. And she wrote me back an email, and she said, you know, one more milestone passed, the first Pesach, until the next milestone, the anniversary of the summer of the wedding, and she wrote in parentheses, non-wedding, the conclusion of a year of tragedies, until we begin the next year of tragedies, and the next year of tragedies, and the next year of tragedies. And I sat there looking at this email, I had no idea how to respond. Just looking at this email, because there is no response. Because death, and especially tragic death, is the incomprehensible. And yet, the Torah seems to suggest otherwise. What is the connection, and how do you make sense of this to a certain degree? By the way, it's very interesting to note that I think the Sefer of one of the Midrashic works suggests that if you look carefully here, it says in the Torah, you know, sort of after the portion, the story of Nadav Nevi'im, that God speaks directly to Aaron. And the rabbis point out that when Moshe comes to comfort Aaron on some level for the loss of his sons, right, after they were struck down by this holy fire from whatever it was that they, mistake that they made, literally at the dedication of the Mishkan, of the tabernacle, it says, Vayidoma Aaron, and Aaron was silent. And because Aaron chose silence rather than to speak out against God, which would be the normal reaction in a situation like that, therefore Hashem rewarded Aaron and spoke to Aaron directly rather than the norm, which was through Moses. So one of the commentators makes a very interesting point. We have a tradition that prophecy cannot be received except in a state of joy. As a matter of fact, according to Jewish tradition, Jeremiah, Yirmiyahu, who wrote the Book of Lamentations, Eicha, which is the book that we read on the 9th of Av, the anniversary of the destruction of the temple. It is absolutely, by far, the most painful, challenging, sorrowful book in the entire 24 books of the Torah, of the larger Torah, including the prophets and the writings. Jewish tradition has it that Jeremiah wrote this as a prophecy before the temple was actually destroyed. Because if he would have waited until after the temple was destroyed, his sorrow would have been so great, he wouldn't have been able to pray. Right? But essentially, only in a state of joy does one communicate with God, because a relationship with God should be based on joy. It should be of joy. So that means that Aaron, who receives a direct communication from God, succeeded in achieving a state of joy, which is amazing. That we're capable of comprehending how one does that, I have no idea. But I do know that joy is all about purpose. The idea that everything that happens in this world happens for a purpose, then you could achieve a state of joy even in the most horrific circumstances. That's not to say that we understand the purpose. I certainly don't understand the purpose. But if you're able to somehow believe that there must be some purpose that eludes you, and you can wrap your hands around that, then you can achieve a state of joy. Right? The closest example I can think of is Kobe Mandel. Kobe Mandel was 14 years old, and he and his friend Yosef Ishran, who lived in Tekoa, were playing hooky from school, and they climbed down the side of the mountain in Tekoa where they live, which is about a 10-minute drive from Efrat, where I live, and they went to this huge, magnificent series of caves called the Haritun, and they were discovered by terrorists, and they were killed, they were murdered, and they were murdered in such a horrible way and beaten so badly with rocks and stones that the only way to identify them, which was through the dental records. How do you ever recover from such a tragedy? How do you ever step beyond? And by the way, if you ever want to read an incredibly powerful book, his mother, Sherry Mandel, wrote a magnificent book. I believe it's called Blessings of a Broken Heart. Don't read this on your birthday. This is a book to read on the 9th of Av, or on Holocaust Memorial Day. It's a very powerful book. And yet you meet Seth, right? And he's a basically happy person. With all the pain and the fact that I'm sure he's different, I didn't really know him well before, right? He's a basically happy person. And I have to imagine that part of that joy comes from what he did as a result of this terrible tragedy. He created a camp for kids who are victims of terror, and it's an incredible thing to see. In fact, my daughter worked in this camp last summer. It's just unbelievable what they do. They take kids who've lost parents in terrorist shootings, who've lost whole families in bombings, and they give them a summer camp. And they rejuvenate them. It's an incredible thing. So that's not to say that this is so simple, right? But it's the fine line between understanding and making something meaningful. You can make something meaningful. You can transform tragedy, right, to some level. I wouldn't say transform it, but you can take away some of the sting of it, maybe, right, by transforming the everyday into the meaningful, all the while being aware that you're not really capable of understanding. And that's where sometimes we make a mistake, because sometimes we let ourselves assume that we're able to understand. And I think personally that can be very dangerous. Which brings us back to kashrut, right? Because on the one hand, it's true that the mitzvah of kashrut is a chok, that we're never really going to fully get it. And yet when you look at the commentaries, Maimonides, for example, they have lots to say on what it is that we're doing in the laws of the dietary laws, and why we're doing it. And perhaps the way of understanding that, right, is that they're not trying to explain necessarily so much as to make the experience meaningful. You know? And it's worth pointing out that there are different approaches to mitzvot in general, right? There is an ethical approach to mitzvot, which suggests that the purpose of Judaism is to make a more ethical world, among other things, and that therefore you need a recipe to do that, and every mitzvah, every commandment is a piece, is a part of that recipe. And therefore the goal, right, is to discover the ethical underpinnings, to decide how a given mitzvah makes me a better human being. Because if I really understood that a mitzvah made me a better person and made the world a better place, then that mitzvah would make a lot of sense to me, even if I didn't really understand it. It would acquire a whole different level of meaning. And that's what making things meaningful is really all about. You know? And what's interesting is that kashrut, more than almost any other mitzvah, kashrut has the potential to epitomize the mundane. Because you basically have a mitzvah that is involved in the everyday to such a degree that no human being will go a day, except in extenuating circumstances, without experiencing the focus of this mitzvah, which is to eat. And we eat so often and so much, especially those, you know, it's an appropriate thing to say right after Pesach, right? But after Passover, but we eat so much and so often that we don't think about it. We're just eating, right? In fact, Judaism has a whole recipe of how to turn eating into a meaningful experience, right? And part of it, of course, are brachot, our blessings. In fact, they say that Gerev, the Rebbe from Sadagura, used to say, right, that the goal is to make saying the blessing before you eat a more joyous experience than the eating itself. So he must have had some sharp chassidim, right, who got it, because one of his chassidim said to him, one of his followers, said, but Rebbe, that's impossible. That's so hard. How could you do that? You know, you come home, you're starving, and your wife has just made this incredible steak. And you're so excited, and you sit down to eat the steak, and you're not even thinking about the steak. You're so excited at the opportunity to enjoy the blessing. So there aren't many people who achieve that level. I know I'm not. I mean, I enjoy a given blessing, but then there's the steak. So his response to him was, it's true, and it may not even be possible in this world, but at least you can know how it's meant to be, what could be, right? To transform the given, the mundane, into the meaningful. You know, it's interesting. This was our first Pesach as a family, home in Israel in about, I don't know, 6 years, right? Because we went to Florida, you know, for 3 years, and we were there, and then we came back and went back to Pesach a couple times. So we haven't been home for, I don't know, the last five Pesach Seders. So for me personally, this was just an unbelievable Pesach experience. Just the chance to be with the family, to be at home, not to have to pack, not to have to go anywhere, not to work. But I have to say that of all the moments, there are two that stand out. On the Thursday of the intermediate days, you know, sort of a couple of days after the Seder, so we decided we didn't want to go away anywhere, because just the thought of having a Pesach without packing or checking in or checking out. So we woke up really early, and we were on the road by like, I don't know, 6:45, and we drove all the way up to the Golan Heights. And took my family to Gamla. Now, I've been to Gamla in the summer, but I've never been there in the winter. Gamla is an Aramaic word, which in Hebrew would be Hagamal. Right? The Kamatz and the Aleph, the Ah sound at the end of a word in Aramaic, which is the language of the Talmud, is the same as the He, the Ha sound at the beginning of a Hebrew word. So Gamla would be Hagamal, the camel. And Josephus, who was a historian, you know, who lived in the time of the destruction of the temple, and who has left us an eyewitness account of the experiences of the Roman destruction of the Judean kingdom and the temple in the year 70, he describes the city of Gamla and the subsequent battle that took place there. It's an amazing story. And, you know, it was sort of the stuff of legends, surrounded by legions. They held up as long as they could in the middle of the night, the battle. And no one ever knew where Gamla was. There was no source material, you know. There was no map or geography or anywhere like that. And really, really, that was one of the only sources for the name of the city, Gamla, right? So we eventually realized that such a place did exist because they found a couple of other sources, but no one knew where it was until a professor from Haifa University was doing a hike. You know, he was with some students and sort of hiking out in nature. And they came across a valley in the Golan Heights, and sort of above the Kinneret, and he looks up at this mountain, sitting like the hump of a camel between two steep ravines on either side, facing south towards the Kinneret, and realizes that this is exactly the way Josephus described the city of Gamla. So they climbed up this mountain, they started to look around, and they realized that there were ruins there, and they eventually got funding, and they did a dig, and they discovered the city of Gamla. And they actually discovered the breach in the wall. You know, the city was surrounded by Vespasian and his Roman legions before he became the emperor on his march south to Jerusalem. Josephus describes how they took apart the siege tower, which you can still see, right, in the middle of the night, and how they breached the walls with the battering rams, and how the defenders of Gamla were so overcome with exhaustion that they were asleep, until they woke up with the Romans in their midst, and the terror and the screaming, and the last 5,000 of them gathered on the top of the mountain with the last pitched defense, and finally realizing that they could not hold out, rather than fall prey to the Romans, throw themselves to their deaths, according to Josephus, in the steep, steep, steep ravines below. And if you know the story, it's a powerful place to visit. In fact, the oldest synagogue in the world is in Gamla, right? And there's some fascinating details about it. So on the one hand, you know, this is the site of a massacre of Jews. And here I am, on Pesach, with my family, going out for a nature hike, you know, with a picnic in our rucksack. Could you imagine, 1,000 years from now, Jews, they want to go to Poland, they're going to make a picnic on the grounds of Treblinka. So that's ridiculous. And yet at the same time, the fact that you're climbing down this mountain, and walking across the ruins of Gamla is the real ending to the story. Because the Romans thought the story was over in the year 69 CE, 68 CE. But we, climbing down that mountain, are demonstrating that the story was just beginning. We've written the final chapter in that story with the birth of the State of Israel. And at a certain point, when you're climbing down the mountain, you turn around to look up the hill you've just come down. It's a steep climb. And there's a magnificent waterfall that comes pouring out of the mountainside. It's called the Tanur. It's the tallest waterfall in Israel. And they actually closed the trail to the waterfall. We had thought to make it there because they were protecting some eagles that, you know, nests, really vulture nests that are up in the hills there. And unexpectedly, you turn around and you see this huge waterfall, and my four children are kind of coming down the mountain behind me. They've all got these smiles on their faces. There's a water. It just doesn't get better than that. It just doesn't get any better than that. And you're climbing down this hill because you want to get to Gamla. But But of course, then you realize you're so busy trying to get there, you're missing where you already are. You know? So I just took a moment to appreciate what an unbelievable gift it is to be in Israel, in a modern state of Israel, with everything that we have, on my way down to visit Gamla. Right? That's a decision. That's not a reaction. That's a decision to make a moment meaningful, to transform the given minute. The entire message of Kashrut is that the power, right? We don't have the power to control the events around us. But we absolutely have the power to choose how those events affect us. And that is part of the message of Kashrut. And I'll give you just one quick idea about the laws of Kashrut. And then maybe we'll open the floor to, or the airwaves to questions. You know, it's an interesting question, right? Why is it that you take meat, which is kosher, and you take milk, which is kosher, and we choose not to eat them together, right? And why is it that the symbols that represent the fact that an animal is unkosher, right? Imagine you're in the desert, and you just, you know, you don't know whether an animal is kosher. Some animal, you know, you're dying of hunger, you're in the wilderness, and you see an animal, but you don't know if it's kosher or not, right? And you happen to have your handy-dandy ritual slaughter knife in your rucksack, right? This is a theoretical question, and I get to paint it. But you don't know if it's a kosher animal. So you can ritually slaughter an animal correctly, but if it's an unkosher animal, you can't ritually slaughter a pig. So the Torah tells me that there are two signs that an animal is kosher. And the Torah actually goes so far out on a limb as to suggest that there are only four animals, right? There are only four animals that have one of these signs and not the other. Right? That either chew their cud or have split hooves, but not both. And the pig is the only animal that has split hooves and does not chew its cud. That's what the Torah tells us. And by the way, it's interesting, although my relationship with Torah and faith and everything else is not based on these tidbits, it is interesting that 3,000 years later, and some 50,000 zoological species that we've discovered later, there is still only one species in the entire world that has split hooves and does not chew its cud, and that's the family of the pig. Right? And the hog and whatever. But in any event, why are these the symbols? This is how you know an animal is kosher, because it chews its cud. I mean, do you know what it means that an animal chews its cud? It means that it eats and it swallows and begins the process of digesting. And then as part of the digestive process, it regurgitates it, chews it again. That's what it means. It's chewing its cud. The cud is the ingested, digested fodder of food. And then eats it again. Swallows again. So what makes an animal kosher? That it eats its own vomit. I mean, that's ridiculous. So what is this? So Diane Grunfeld wrote a magnificent article. He was one of the great rabbis of England. Wrote a magnificent article, actually a two-volume set of books, called The Dietary Laws. And he has an introduction to that series in which he discusses this question and points out a very interesting thing. You know, meat represents cruelty. And it represents the hunt. In fact, Esav is the Ish Tzai, the Ish Sadeh. He's the man of the field. He's the man of the hunt. And he is associated with cruelty in the Torah. Right? It's associated with death. Meat is all about death, because in order to eat meat, you have to kill a living creature. In fact, initially, we weren't supposed to necessarily be eating meat. If you look very carefully at the verses in the Torah, in the time of when the world was created and Adam and Eve were created, it says, "Mikol Eitz Hagan Achol Tochel," right? From all the trees you can eat, right? Esav Mazria Zera, from the grasses and the plants, right? But not from the meat. We only start to eat meat after the flood, almost as if God is saying, you've killed, you've been violent, you had a flood, take it out on the animal. Better that than to kill each other, right? So meat represents cruelty and it represents the hunt. Milk, on the other hand, milk represents mercy. Milk represents life. I mean, that's how baby animals live, because they drink their mother's milk. In fact, there is no greater symbol of mercy in literature than mother's milk. Comes along the Torah and says, you need to know the difference. You need to know the difference between what is merciful and what is cruel, between life and death, between giving and taking. You need to have a clear line in life. And it's not always so simple. One man's cruelty is another man's kindness. Like the Kevorkian case. and choosing not to mix meat and milk, suggests Jewish tradition, I take a moment every time I eat to consider the cruelty and kindness and the lines between them only make sense if there is some objective line. If cruelty and kindness are totally dependent on us, then when we get to decide what's right and what's wrong, what's cruel and what's kind, well, then one person's cruel is another person's kind. That's very dangerous. That's one of the challenges that atheistic philosophy has to struggle with. Right? That's one of the big challenges, if you think about it. And at the same time, right? At the same time, the ability to know that there are lines and that these items are separate, that changes who we are. So imagine if every time you sit down to eat, you take a moment to consider, right, that you have to be aware of these definitions, that you have to be sure that in your life you're being kind, and that kindness isn't cruel and cruelty isn't kind. You know? What we're going on with here in the Middle East is a perfect case in point. You know, I don't know, not that I'm, God forbid, advocating this, just to be very clear. But if you want a good example of this, you know, when the first Intifada broke out, okay, so it broke out not only in Israel, it broke out in Egypt, right? And the riots of the Intifada spread to Egypt. But the Egyptian Intifada on the other side of the border in Rafiah, which is the southern part of the Gaza Strip, the Intifada there lasted very little time. Because the Egyptians sent an armored personnel carrier with live ammunition that poured into the crowds and basically killed 24 people, if I'm not mistaken, in one afternoon. And that was the end of the Egyptian Intifada. Now, we're a civilized society. We could never do that. You know? A horrible thing to open up on civilians who are legitimately rioting, or not legitimately rioting, and kill 24 people. And yet, you know, after 7 or 8 years of Intifada, there were over 1,000 Arabs dead. And the toll is still rising. Right? So don't get me wrong. We don't have the right to make that decision. But it's healthy to be aware that we don't really know. You know, conversely, you can't imagine what an incredibly difficult decision that you have to live with it is to take a human life. You know? Especially if, you know, different people have different quality traits, but if you're a merciful person, to be in a situation where you actually have to shoot another human being and watch them die. Or God forbid, take out a child who's holding an anti-tank missile, because otherwise your unit is going to get taken out. That's an incredibly cruel thing to do. You absolutely know that that child is not responsible for what he's doing. You know that his parents are going to be devastated. They may not even know what he's doing. And you absolutely know that you have no choice and you have to do it. So is that cruel or is that kind? The fact that you struggle with that question makes you a better person. And Judaism believes that it's not enough just to have ideas. And so if you choose to transform the everyday eating experience into a journey into making life more ethical, then the process of that mitzvah becomes more meaningful. And that's the goal of this portion. The goal of the portion of Shemini, the goal of this week's Torah portion, is that we hold in our hands the ability to transform our own lives through the elevated, the once-in-a-lifetime, the moment that stands out as singular in history, such as the dedication of the tabernacle, which would never be repeated. There's only one day in Jewish history where the tabernacle, the Mishkan, was dedicated for the first time. There's only one day when the high priest came into being. There's only one day when Nadav and Avihu offered a fire poured from heaven. It doesn't get higher than that. I mean, you have to understand who Nadav and Avihu, Aaron's sons, were. According to the verses in the 24th chapter in Perek Chavdal of Shemot, When Moshe went up to Mount Sinai, so the Jewish people all sat below. The elders were closer to the mountain. Joshua followed Moshe halfway up the mountain. Who on the mountain was in between the elders below and Yoshua above? Nadav and Avihu. So these were people on a very high level. You can transform the high level, the moment of power, and you can also transform the mundane. And we choose whether we will decide to make mitzvot and consequently the everyday living experience more meaningful.
This presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990 or in Jerusalem at country code 972-627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.